You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here, we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator and your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host. And I have to tell you, there's so much going on in the nonprofit sector these days, particularly around fundraising and generating resources for charities. And what we're going to talk about today, I bet most people listening to this podcast will never have heard of. I've been following this movement now for about 10 years, though, so it's been out there. But I am certain that many people will not be aware that there are organizations that enable bonds to be created. That's right, bonds that people can acquire or invest in. And the proceeds from these bonds are used by social good organizations to create change in the world. And if they work, the bondholders get paid. Well, we're going to talk with someone who's right at the center of this. Our guest today, Tracy Palangian, who is the CEO and co-founder of Social Finance. Social Finance is a national impact finance nonprofit that builds innovative partnerships and investments to measurably improve lives. Tracy's been doing this since 2011. And I have to say, they are on to some really interesting and forward-thinking ways to fund social good. So Tracy, it's great to have you here. Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast.
Great to be with you, Art.
Tracy, I want to talk with you about this exciting work you're doing at Social Finance and find out about your life, what led you to take on this important work, and just give our listeners some exposure to a whole new world of how nonprofit and social good is actually being funded. So I'm really glad that you're here and you've agreed to do this. I think our listeners, many of them who aren't necessarily connected with nonprofit work on a day-to-day basis, may not even be aware that this kind of activity exists. So we're really excited to have you. So let me ask you, just to get started, what is Social Finance? When did it get started, and what are you trying to accomplish?
Well, again, it's great to be with you, Art. Yes, indeed, Social Finance is a pretty unusual nonprofit. It's a pretty funky model that we're trying to get out into the world. And I have the great privilege of starting Social Finance with my two fantastic mentors and fellow travelers and friends in Sir Ronald Cohen and David Blood back at the end of 2010 was when we got Social Finance started. So it's a good 11 years. And we started Social Finance with a pretty ambitious goal, which is, how do we think about new models to finance social change? And how do we work at the intersection of finance and policy and philanthropy to get the kind of results, measurable results for our communities in a meaningful and lasting way? So over the years, we have built innovative partnerships and investment models to improve lives, again, in a measurable way. We take outcomes very seriously, and hopefully we'll get into some of these examples, Art. And we do this through kind of two business lines, our impact finance line and our impact advisory business line. So it's been quite a journey, and I have to say that the work is incredibly hard, working across sectors, working across disciplines, trying to marry different incentives and to reallocate risk differently, to really try to change the systems, the social and economic systems that we all live in, so that more people can benefit from them.
Yeah, well, that's terrific. So let's get into a particular project per se. What are the elements of a successful project that your organization might run through, let's say, the social finance portion that's really dealing with these transactions?
Yeah, thank you, Art. I think I'm going to give an example of a career impact bond. And before we even get into what the career impact bond is, over the last 10 years, we have pioneered several instruments. One of them is called the social impact bond that you may have heard of. And this is public-private partnership to enable the public sector to pay for social programs only in the event of success. And we applied that mechanism across many different issue areas, from economic opportunities for low-income workers to addressing homelessness to challenges in the criminal justice system, etc. And then around 2018-19, this is before the pandemic, we started really focusing on economic opportunities and economic mobility, or the lack thereof, or the stagnancy of such, and really decided to hone in into that particular issue area, and such that now probably half of our portfolio is focused on economic opportunities and economic mobility. Broadly speaking, on the impact investing arm of the shop, if you will, we have mobilized over $225 million to directly serve and seeing improved outcomes for over 35,000 individuals. Outcomes in improved education, economic mobility, health, housing, etc. So a specific example in the Career Impact Bond is one that I'd like to talk about in the diesel mechanic transportation services industry. And I don't know, I wasn't very familiar with the transportation services world, but if you look at any statistic, you'll see that we have a massive labor shortage of diesel technicians around the country. Some estimates say that we have a 200,000 number shortage in the next 5 years. Not least, this number is increasing every day with the increased demand that we're all playing a part of, right? All the boxes that show up at our doorsteps. And many trucking companies, transportation companies, see a massive shortage of diesel technicians to service the trucks, whether it's long haul or short haul. Yet these credentialing programs that get folks into the diesel mechanic sector and build a career around being a diesel mechanic is actually quite difficult to access for a lot of the priority populations that we focus on. By the way, these are not two-year degrees that you have to go, you know, to a community college to get. These are typically programs that you can achieve. These credentials are short-term. 350 hours in a shop, in a diesel mechanic shop, you can graduate with a diesel mechanic certificate and get a really great job that can pay a family-sustaining wage. So this is one area, Art, that we've been very focused on. And I'll give you an example of, I don't know if you saw the New York Times article, which was focused on the diesel mechanic opportunity. And there's a massive picture in the front page of the business section, which was where the article was the picture of Billy Barber, one of our students in the diesel mechanic program, which is out of the American Diesel Training Center in Ohio. And Billy was working as, I think, a cable installer, making around $30,000 a year. And he's always had an interest in becoming a diesel technician. And so he was dealing with TV cable and installation, and then he wanted to get into this program, but the program was completely out of reach for him in terms of the tuition sticker price. The program cost $10,000. And so he enrolled in our Career Impact Bond program, where he could access this training course with ADTC, American Diesel Training Center, at no upfront cost to him. But the deal, if you will, is that he would enter into a Career Impact Bond arrangement whereby if he sees improved earnings as a result of this program, he would then pay a fixed amount on a monthly basis around, depending on whether he gets a tool set or not, around $180 a month, whereby he would only pay that amount every month if he keeps this job that he gets. And now, around a year later, I just heard from our partners at ADTC that Billy is making over $60,000 a year as a diesel technician, and with tremendous upward mobility, going up that economic escalator as he assumes management roles and sales roles over time if he wishes to. So that's just one example of unlocking training opportunities for a population that would never have the savings or the credit to access these kinds of programs with pretty large tuition costs up front.
So let's talk about the elements of the transaction itself. Who are engaged in both the creation of the bonds, the repayment? I mean, who are the partners to the transaction that you bring together to make this happen?
It's a great question. At the end of the day, if students are enrolling at no upfront cost, who is providing that upfront cost, right? So a Career Impact Bond can be expressed or applied in different settings. And I'll give you the first example, which is in an impact investing setting. So we have raised a $50 million fund. We just had our third close in August of this year, and hoping to get to a final close at the end of 2021, where to date, we've raised $50 million from what we call impact investors. These are folks from the foundation community or individual investors. So our limited partners include Blue Meridian Partners and the MacArthur Foundation and the Michael and Susan Dell Foundation, Pershing Square Foundation, as well as many donors investing through their donor advised funds. So we have a couple dozen investors to date, and that number is continuing to grow, where they've committed $50 million, but they're committing that money not as grant dollars, but they're hoping to get their money back. Now, they're not looking for outsized returns. We call this an impact-first investment vehicle, whereby they first and foremost care about the impact, and they hope to get their money back, both return of capital and a modest return on capital. So this is the capital source. Then we work with vetted training providers, whether it's ADTC, which is the example that I mentioned, or we have three training providers in the IT space. The Global Coding Bootcamp General Assembly is a core partner of ours. In fact, that was the first partnership that we launch out of the UP Fund, which is this $50 million impact investment fund. We also have a great IT training program out west called Acuitas in California, as well as Alchemy, which is in the Pacific Northwest. So these vetted training providers have a track record of serving the population that we care about, delivering tremendous outcomes for these folks, both in terms of job placement, starting salary, and sustained wages. And they have the capacity to scale to take on more people. And so with the capital source, which is these investors and the training providers, we then devise what a Career Impact Bond program might look like. So I mentioned the example with ADTC, the diesel mechanic program, already. So another program is with General Assembly, and General Assembly is actually a $15,000, 15-week full-time program, whereby people come out with software engineering skills and UX design skills, skills that the 21st century economy requires. And they've just had an amazing track record of delivering people into the labor force in the IT space. Yet General Assembly, with a $15,000 tuition, is inaccessible for the populations that social finance cares about, you know, populations from marginalized communities of color, people who've been in the criminal justice system, people who've been underemployed. And so we devised a program with General Assembly, hand in glove, co-designed this program, whereby we actually articulated what the eligibility criteria are for admitting people into the Career Impact Bond program. And this is the criteria that we came up together. You can enroll in this program if you've been on public benefits like the SNAP or WIC or TANF, or you've been on the Earned Income Tax Credit program, or you've been in the criminal justice system, or your FICO score is just insufficient for you to qualify for a loan. So once we identify folks that fall into those eligibility criteria, they get to enroll in the General Assembly software engineering class or UX design class at no upfront cost to them. And for General Assembly, the Korean PAC bond terms are such that if you graduate from the program and you earn more than $40,000, that's the minimum income threshold, then you pay 10% of your monthly salary for every month that you stay employed above that minimum income threshold. And if at any given point that you fall out of the labor force or your income falls below that threshold, you're not on the hook to pay anything. So that downside protection is really, really meaningful for folks, because if you get a loan, you're stuck to pay that monthly loan payment regardless of your employment outcomes. And there are also other protections in place, such as the time limit of it. You're off the hook after 4 years in the General Assembly case, or if you hit your payment cap. So all of this, what we call the ISA terms, the Income Share Agreement terms, are all articulated in the Student Bill of Rights that everyone signs on to, the training provider, the investors, the students themselves, such that the student remains at the center of the arrangement. So thousands of students will enroll through these programs in the UP Fund. And at the aggregate, we hope that the investors will get their principal back plus a very, very modest rate of return.
So let's talk for a minute about the students, the people you're serving and getting through the education process. We know in colleges and universities, ultimately somewhere around 50%, if we're lucky, graduate with a four-year degree. And in many cases, folk who don't graduate have significant student loans that will carry with them for the rest of their lives in many cases, and it'll affect their ability to get credit and all sorts of things if they default. Your program, though, seems to be less onerous in that, for one thing, it's focused on a career, so that we know if the person does get through the program, they're going to get a job paying more than they currently make, hopefully substantially more. And then secondly, if they're not able to get that job paying more, then what they have to pay goes down or gets eliminated, because these bondholders understand going in that it's a possibility that they may not get paid. They're perfectly willing, it seems, to transfer their investment into a donation, assuming that the person does not get through the program. So let's talk for a minute about the percentages of people who actually succeed. What are you seeing in terms of success with that?
It's too early to tell in the aggregate. So for the UP Fund, we have served over 1,500 students to date. Some of them are still in the training. Some of them are out of the training and getting a job. So for the diesel mechanic program, we're seeing 99% graduation rates, which are extraordinary percentages, and a significant number of them getting a job within the grace period. In fact, there's such a labor shortage, Art, that many of these students are actually pre-committed hires by employers already. And the other beauty for that program, Art, is that for the employers, many of them are actually willing to pay that monthly Korean PAC bond payment on behalf of the student for every month that the worker stays successfully in the job. So that's because bad. They experience the cost of turnover, the cost of hiring, and they say, hey, if the person's staying successfully in the job, it's cheaper for me to keep the person and pay off the obligation for them. So it's too early to aggregate, but the whole idea that you mentioned earlier, that the student loan program is just potentially such a bad deal for so many people, is absolutely true. Not only is the graduation rate so low, even if for those who graduate with a four-year degree, often they're not landing great jobs and putting their degrees to work. Lo and behold, you have, you know, over 40 million Americans holding collectively over $1 trillion of student debt. It's just crippling for so many people. Yet, there are so many great jobs, family-sustaining, great jobs with decent pay, with advancement potential, that do not require a four-year degree in the American labor force. More than 50% of jobs in the American labor force are what we call middle skills jobs that pay a middle-class salary, You just need some specialized training beyond a high school degree. It could be a diesel mechanic certificate. It could be a truck driver license. It could be a certification in IT, whether it's, you know, software engineering or cyber or UX design. It could be in green energy. You know, if you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the fastest growing segment is actually solar panel installers and wind turbine technicians. These are jobs of the future. These are industries of the future, and we need to equip folks with the skills to access these industries of the future. And many of these jobs are what we call middle skills jobs, and that is very much what the Career Impact Bond is focused on, those occupations in those sectors. And we're really, really encouraged by the early results. And as you said, if only a smaller fraction of people attain jobs and maintain those jobs, then quote-unquote, our model predicts, investors might lose 10 cents on the dollar. We're just very grateful that there are these, quote-unquote, impact-first investors or philanthropically motivated investors whose aim, first and foremost, is to achieve the impact, and the financial return, in this case, is secondary.
Tracy, I don't know if you know, but I used to work in job training. I used to head an organization called Opportunities Industrialization Centers of America.
Well reputed.
Yeah. So OIC was and is, in my opinion, the premier workforce development community-based organization in the country. And one of the things we found out doing our work, which is primarily funded by government, the Department of Labor and state governments, that if we could get a percentage even of people through the program, that percentage of people would more than pay for the cost of the program for the entire lot of people we were serving because of the savings to society that the profile of people were likely to have to deal with. So if a person did not touch an OIC program, at least the type of individuals we're dealing with, chances are that they might end up in jail. They might end up unemployed and dependent on others, or they might be working in a low wage or no wage job and not paying taxes. So if we could aggregate the savings plus the taxes that they were paying over a course of their lifetime, we could more than pay for the cost of the program with just a few people succeeding. Now, with your program, society is benefiting. I can't even fathom it because really the government is not putting anything in, at least for this program. And I'm just wondering, is there any opportunity or interest either on your part or the government's part to support these investments in to some extent and maybe leverage it with some additional dollars so that you could do more people? I don't know what your thinking is on that, but
it's absolutely a strategy that we have been pursuing coming out of the pandemic. I guess we're still in a pandemic, but we're putting the Career Impact Bond to use in two ways. So we just talked about the Impact Investment Vehicle, which involve investors who look to get their money back and in a 10-year fund life, and it's a typical impact investment vehicle. But we're also putting the Career Impact Bond to work in a public sector setting. And we call these funds Pay It Forward Funds, PIFF, if you will. And here, instead of anchoring a fund with investment dollars, we're anchoring a fund with public dollars. And we're working with several states now, half a dozen states around the country, whereby governors and in some cases county mayors are anchoring these funds with public dollars, either public dollars from the state's workforce development budgets or rescue plan dollars. I mean, I think we all appreciate that many governors have now this massive injection of capital, you know, kind of once in a generation, large sums of money to deploy in their communities. And we're working with some governors who are putting American Rescue Plan dollars to anchor these pay it forward funds. And it works in the same way. The fund is powered by public dollars. Low-income workers, people who are unemployed, underemployed, people who've been displaced by the pandemic would access high-quality training programs with the help of these dollars. And then for the successful graduates and workers, they repay back into the fund such that their payment would finance a future cohort of workers to benefit from the program. So we call it pay it forward funds. In some cases, you can do the modeling such that it evergreens. In some cases, you can do the modeling that you can stretch that public dollars into several years. And it's kind of like an aha moment for governors, because right now they spend money and it's one and done, right? It's out the door. It's one-time grant use. It goes to train someone and off they go. Here, the successful workers would repay back into the fund to finance future students. So engaging with the public sector is still critical to really solve our social challenges at scale, Art, as you remarked. And the ROI, financial ROI, just makes all the sense in the world in a public sector setting, not to even mention the power and autonomy that people feel when they can get on to better livelihoods. So we're really, really excited about this strategy.
All right. Well, Tracy, what I want to know is, why in the world did you take this on? I understand that, you know, you're helping a lot of people, but, you know, let's face it, when reading your background, you come out of investment banking and, you know, the cold steel making money business, you know. I mean, what in the world would get someone on your trajectory from a career standpoint to say, wait a minute, let's take the financial industry and turn it sideways and figure out how we can get it to work for people who, many of whom, don't even have bank accounts? What was it, Tracy? Where did this come from? Who are you?
Who am I? Well, where should we begin? You're kind to ask that question. I feel incredibly lucky, Art, that Ronald Cohen, David Blood, and I started this very different kind of enterprise 11 years ago. Candidly, I wasn't looking to start something. So just to backtrack, first of all, I didn't grow up in this country. My entire family is still in Hong Kong, which is where I grew up. I came to the United States as a teenager to go to school. I was lucky to go to a fabulous college where I met a boy. And this boy kind of semi-convinced me to stay in this country after I graduated from college and become an American and make a life in this country. And this boy is now my husband, and together we have three daughters. But it was one of these things that the first accident was that I decided to stay in this country when my mother, my brothers, the rest of my extended family is in a very different part of the world. So that's the first accident. And I find it to be a very lucky accident. And social finance is also one of these lucky accidents. I was, as you mentioned, kind of hobbling along, and really, I was very happy doing what I was doing. And I had a very meaningful and successful career in asset management and in consulting, all the while raising three daughters. It was hard, right? Like, kind of like every day at a time when you're raising little kids and going to work. And around like 15 years ago, maybe around 2005, I had an itch to want to spend more time in the world of social change. And I was at a firm called Parthenon at that time, which is a management consulting firm, which is now part of Ernst & Young now. And I created a not-for-profit practice area, whereby my clients would all be foundations and NGOs around the world, and I would kind of get my share of reward by helping them achieve their missions more effectively, and that would be kind of my channel to give back. And one thing led to another, and it was in that context, leading the not-for-profit practice at Parthenon, that I met Ronald Cohen and David Blood in the UK, and they were getting social finance up and running in the UK in 2007. And we helped them figure out the model, just as good old strategy consultants. And for the first time, it was almost like the skies parted for me. there's a new way to think bring about social change. Yes, philanthropy is hugely important. The nonprofit sector is hugely important. Government as a policy lever is hugely important to bring about broad-scale social change. But there is a role for the capital markets to also enable social progress. And how do you enlist private capital into the arena to bring about both social impact, measurable social impact, as well as financial impact for investors? And at the end of the day, finance is simply finance. It's a technical craft. You can use it either to enrich oneself, or you can use it as a publicly spirited responsibility to improve people's lives. And that's very much the mission of social finance. How do you devise new financial instruments? How do you devise new partnerships so that people are at the center, outcomes are at the center, but doing it in a way that is regenerative? Because when you use investment dollars, the money comes back, and then you can have more impact with it. So that's very much the inspiration behind the founding of social finance. And in the last 11 years, we've learned so much. We've made so many mistakes. We've had our fair share of failures doing something kind of so cross-sector and so complicated, as you can imagine, is full of potholes and landmines. And we've made our kind of fair share of mistakes, as I mentioned, and we've built the social impact bond. We're now expanding that repertoire into the career impact bond. We are really excited about other new instruments. Unlocking donor advised funds for impact is yet another avenue that we've been at, and it's incredibly exciting. And the journey has just begun. And in a strange way, Art, and you write this beautifully in your newsletter last night, this concept of momentum. And we feel that the pandemic, COVID, has almost like accelerated our work. The last 18 months have been extraordinary. The idea, you know, in this Pay It Forward Fund context that we just mentioned, that we're getting phone calls from mayors and governors around the country and say, hey, help us make our workforce dollar work harder for us, produce outcomes for our communities. It's just an extraordinary moment to be in, to lean in, and we feel very fortunate.
Well, yes, and you mentioned momentum. I think that for a lot of people, it's been a tale of two worlds, right? I mean, for many people, the pandemic has killed momentum and has dragged on their ability to succeed. I think of young students in schools who are going to be years behind probably as a result of the pandemic now. But I think programs that you're putting together can shift that, can change that. So it's good to see that you're actually growing at this point, because I would probably gather that you're still only a small percentage.
Tiny.
A tiny percentage.
Of the need out there.
And of the need, right. So the potential is enormous.
Millions of people are out of work. There are over 10 million mm-hmm. unfilled job openings being posted by business. You know, they're unfilled. Yeah. And we're working in such a, there's just so much opportunity. Yeah. And you're right.
And you speak the language of wealthy people.
What does that mean?
Well, what it means is, what you're basically saying is, put some money into this and maybe you'll get something back. And therefore, we have much greater opportunity to lever their resources to create social good. That's what I'm saying.
I absolutely agree with you, Art. I mean, talk about divergence between the stock market and Main Street, right? This has been a tremendous time of wealth accumulation for folks, and the markets have done so well. You're absolutely right. The investors that we work with, they really want to lean in. Not least the next generation are really pushing to express their values and their investment portfolios. And some people say, you know, you shouldn't compromise financial return to achieve social impact. Well, the people that we work with, they say you shouldn't have to compromise impact to achieve financial returns. So this new class of impact investors, these impact first investors, is very much wind in our sails.
No, that's great to hear. And what we're seeing on the philanthropic side is that if it weren't for wealthy folk, the dollars going to charities would be significantly lower because the average person we're seeing not give as frequently as they have in the past. And there could be lots of reasons for that. I'm working with a group called the Generosity Commission to try to figure out and develop policy answers for how we can get the average person in the public, the average family, to give to philanthropic organizations. This podcast is all about getting people to give and serve, just average people. And we don't just want wealthy people giving, right? Because that's a whole different society that we would be creating if we gave all of the influence to wealthy people for how our social programs would operate. However, we can certainly see through your program that there's great opportunity for people to make a difference in the lives of everyone else who don't have access to the tools that they need to succeed. I wonder if there's a way to use these dollars to help entrepreneurs as well. I know that some of the work that you're doing is helping entrepreneurs. When you talk about people in design, people who do software development, these folk can kind of work as independent contractors if they chose. But I wonder if there's opportunities to help entrepreneurs from disadvantaged communities get the skills that they need in order to start their business and maybe even some financing. I guess that model is kind of more like the traditional capital model. But we know that in the African-American community, which finally is seeing some growth in the number of businesses, the growth in self-employment, that part of the reason that African-Americans are usually unemployed at double the rate of the majority population is that we don't have small businesses that are hiring them. And so we could get more small businesses going, we could get more people hired, and you'd have more parity. So if we can find through your program some opportunities for that, that would be quite interesting too. So I encourage you to think about how that could be done.
Absolutely. And there's just great momentum in Washington too. The CDFI program, as you know, has had a huge injection into community development finance institutions and CDCs and Black-owned banks. And it's a really rich area to explore for us going forward as well.
Well, Tracy, we're getting to the end of this. And I just want to thank you on behalf of all of the people you're serving. Because frankly, you have access to a community that not many people have access to. And you could very easily have said, my world is fine. I'm doing okay. My kids are growing up successfully and our family is doing great. And I have all these friends who are doing things and that's wonderful. But you decided to do something different and to make a difference. And we need people who have the kind of access that you have to put that stake in the ground, to inspire others who have significant wealth, to put that wealth to work to help change our society. So I want to just hold you up as an example, and I hope that other people will be listening to this who maybe are also similarly situated. And they will call on their friends to do something similar to what you're doing, or maybe even join in to what you're doing, or make investments into social finance, because these are models that were needed. Now, I recognize that what you're doing is not going to be without critics. You know, there are going to be people who say, yeah, right. Well, if I had this, I could do this, that, and the other thing. Well, you don't, and they do, and they're doing it. So let's let them do it. And if it works, we're all much better for it. So anyway, I just wanted to thank you again, to hold you up. I hope you'll be active in our podcast community. You know, we have this community of former guests who are connected at least by me once a week. I hope you will engage in that group.
It would be an honor to be part of your community, Art.
Thank you. Well, you've been listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Tracy Palangian, the co-founder and CEO at Social Finance. And I hope you've enjoyed her story. And I hope you'll listen to our future podcast episodes, which you can find on all major podcast platforms. Thank you very much.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. Send your comments and ideas to Nona@thusmarket.com. That's Nona@thusmarket.com. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's Terms of Service.